or a Stretton Reel 4. And what did your duties at in AD as a clerk involve?
It was pure air policy, and there were three of us. We were the and a corporal, three LACs, a corporal and a flight sergeant, clerks, all of us. We were the clerks to two officers, a squadron leader Nicholas and a flight lieutenant Hallahan, and it was air policy in Iraq. I found it rather dull. And uninteresting, and henceforth the mornings were very, very long. There was no afternoon. We were in the office from 8 until 1. Being air headquarters, like the record office at Ryslip, it dealt with all aspects of clerical work and administrative work appertaining to Iraq Command. I think that some of the sections would have presented some quite interesting work. For instance, the orderly room. Had I gone into the orderly room, I should have done similar work to what I did on 57 Squadron, except that, of course, Air Headquarters wasn't a flying unit. I did get some opportunity, though, for flying in Iraq, because both of my section officers, Nicholas and Hallahan, they were both flying personnel, and by regulations had to do a certain number of hours each month. And they used to go up to one of the squadrons upon the aerodrome. It was a matter of about a mile and a half, but there were always these little tenders popping about, and so we walked nowhere. They used to go to other stations in Iraq, stations like Habaniya, at that time it was called Diban, and Shaiba, Basra. There was one other, I've forgotten it now. They would go there. Sometimes they'd fly up there on duty. Sometimes it would be a social visit. Sometimes for a whole weekend. I would naturally get to hear about it, ask if I could go. Quite often I was successful, and I had many interesting flights, and sometimes weekends away from air headquarters at one of these other stations, and invariably I would meet old friends, and then of course it would be a celebration, and very enjoyable.
When you say that you were dealing with matters of air policy in connection with these officers, what can you give me a little bit of a picture of what sort of things you actually did to help them, what services you did for them in the office and generally?
Well, even in those days, and then it was really in its infancy, were the oil interests, particularly in the Persian Gulf, were getting off the ground, and they had to be protected. Well, as you know, the protection and the policing of Iraq was done by the RAF. That was why the RAF was put in Iraq. There was just no army whatsoever. It was all RAF, and all the policing was done. And the policy was handled by the section that I was on. In addition to that, there was the handling of the different tribes, be they hostile or friendly, and you had both.
What I was really getting at was, what was your particular role in the section?
Oh, it was taking down the letters from the officers, be it Hallahan or Nicholas, and taking them down in shorthand, typing them, sending them. It might be to another station, it might be to the British ambassador, it might be to the air ministry, it might be to some sheikh in Bahrain. It could be anything like that. It was purely a secretarial job. And incidentally, it nearly cost me a court martial, that particular job did. This is rather an amusing little story, and not only nearly cost me a court martial, it nearly cost me my pilot's course, because later on, after I'd been accepted for training as a pilot and was waiting to go home, I was called in to Squadron Leader Nicholas, who dictated a letter to me. And I finished it up. I have the honour to be, sir, your obedient servant. And took it in for Nicholas, and he signed it, and I dispatched it. Well, I dispatched that letter off, and off it went to the Air Ministry. The Air Ministry, one always finished the letters in those days like that. To another person, it might be, "I am, sir, your obedient servant." But with the Air Ministry, it was always, "I have the honour to be, sir." And I just saw this letter, "I have the honour to be, sir." I typed it, another Air Ministry letter, and I sent it off and to the Air Ministry. Well, in point of fact, it was a letter to the British Chargé d'Affaires down at Bahrain, and he was one of the exceptions. He too had to be addressed like that, and it was about some important oil concessions, and the letter which should have gone to him was on its way to London, and it was a very, very important one. And he phoned up, and of course it's been sent off. Yes, I took it down in shorthand. I sent it off myself. Hasn't received it. And then another couple of days went, he still hadn't received it, and then it all came to light. A letter of that reference, of that date, had gone to the Air Ministry. It was a secret letter too. And I thought, well, this is it. I thought I was for the chopper. But luckily, Squadron Leader Nicholas, and because I'd got my pilot's course, because it would have been the end of me completely, there's no doubt about that whatsoever, managed to get it smoothed over in a diplomatic way. And that was all because I didn't read who it was to. I just noticed, "I have the honour to be, sir," and took for granted Air Ministry.
You were quite lucky there then.
I was very lucky.
And you, in fact, though you were dealing with these kinds of matters, you would really have preferred to have gone on in the same kind of orderly room, dark role.
Yes, or to have something to do with something more personal. This was terribly impersonal, the work that I was doing, as I was saying, oil concessions and things like that, which terribly important, but didn't interest me as a young man of about 23, when I, as I was then, or less than that, about 22.
Now, you mentioned there that you, in the end, did get accepted to train as a pilot. Now, how was the, what was the actual sequence of events that enabled you to be accepted like that?
Well, it was the ambition of most airmen to be pilots. And the obvious way, or the only way of getting it, was to become a sergeant pilot. That meant fulfilling quite a few conditions. One was you had to be between certain ages. Another, that you had to have left the apprentice school at least for at least 12 months. Another was that you had to be interviewed and you had to be recommended first, which the recommendation meant an interview by senior officers. Then, even after you'd been recommended, you had to be accepted by the Air Ministry. And it all in all, it was 5 or 6 months from when you first applied. Well, you were allowed to apply, I think it was every 6 months. And as soon as I became eligible for acceptance, that was just after a year after I left Ruislip, I started to apply. And I did it regularly every 6 months. But nothing came of it until I got to Iraq. I then was, I got onto the first rung, and I went through these various stages that I've just mentioned to you until I finally got the interview. The interview was quite an interesting one, because not too many clerks got finally recommended. Partly because they hadn't had very much to do with aircraft. They couldn't become air gunners or anything like that. And secondly, they hadn't got very much flying experience. Well, I had done a fair amount of flying on my squadron, that followed up by the amount of flying I'd done in Iraq. And I don't know why, but right from the beginning, I'd carefully logged all the trips that I did. I got a little notebook and I very neatly wrote out each trip, who it was with, time of takeoff, time of landing, and all that sort of thing. And I took this in with me into my interview. And sure enough, one of the interviewing officers said, "What flying experience have you?" And I said, "Oh, quite a bit, sir." "What, as a clerk?" I says, "Yes, sir." And I took from my pocket this notebook and handed it over. And all three of them, they pored over it for 2 or 3 minutes. And one of them smiled and said, "You do seem to be keen." Well, that seemed to have done the trick, because actually I found out from my subsequent intimacy with the other clerks who dealt with the training of pilots, the clerical work involved, that I'd been placed fairly high up on the recommendation list. There were over 60 who applied. 60 who were chosen to be interviewed, and 25 of us were recommended for training.
Before we talk about what you did when you came back to England, how in general terms did you enjoy your time in Iraq? What was life like there?
Except for the period in the office, which I wasn't particularly interested in, the life out there I did enjoy. Although I didn't see a lot outside the camp, I think I went down into Baghdad once for a social visit. We weren't encouraged to go down there. It was possible to go and visit brothels and things like that, but it wasn't prevalent, certainly not among the lads that I mixed with at Air Headquarters. So I did go down once, and I found it terribly expensive, even to go into a nightclub and have a couple of drinks. So I didn't repeat it. But I always found plenty to do in the camp itself. Sport was a great thing, of course. When it wasn't too hot, some of the year, of course, it was far too hot to go out and play tennis or any take part in any of the sports because in July the temperature would reach 120 sometimes, the shade temperature. But when it wasn't too hot, there were plenty of opportunities for tennis. I virtually lived on the tennis courts. I was very, very fond of tennis. And swimming, very, very lovely swimming bath, and you could always say the water's never cold. And in the winter, there was rugby and football and hockey went on. I played rugby at school, and I joined in the soccer too, and in the hockey. I learned to play hockey out there. Sport always interested me, and the cross country too. I ran in the cross country team of Air Headquarters, and this stood me in good stead, of course, when I went for my interview for the pilot's course, because great stress is laid on sport in the Air Force, so that helped quite considerably.
What was the food like?
Oh, the food was very good. It was made very good by the cooks. It was, I should say, the majority of it, or an awful lot of it at any rate, was tins. The meat was virtually all tinned. But we had plenty of variety, plenty of fruit, plenty of eggs. But a lot of the things, as I said, came in tins or dried milk and that sort of thing. I never saw any fresh milk that I remember.
Were any precautions taken against germs?
Oh, yes, indeed. All the fruit was dipped in antiseptic, one could taste it, but one got used to it. After a time, eating the dates and grapes and things like that that had been dipped in an antiseptic was no hardship at all. You just became accustomed to it.
Were you homesick at all?
I was courting when I went out there. And so, of course, I was sorry to go, but as she couldn't wait for me, and I got a letter. Incidentally, they were always known as mess pots, these letters were, when a lad got a letter from his girl saying that she couldn't wait. Mess pots, of course, from the old Mesopotamia. I don't think it worried me very much. And then when I knew that I'd been recommended for training as a pilot, and it wasn't really so very long after I went out there. I think that I went out there, I think, in the January, and I was recommended for training in the September. Then I knew I was going to come home. little realizing that I might have a court martial, but I didn't know about that then.
So eventually you came back to this country in February 1938, and you'd been accepted for this pilot's course. Where were you sent when you arrived back?
Oh, to Uxbridge, first of all. Royal Air Force Depot, non-effective Uxbridge. Non-effective because you weren't doing anything there. You were just waiting to go to the first flying training school, which was, I think, a wait of some weeks, possibly 3 or 4 weeks. During which time I was on leave. One always had leave when one had returned from abroad, and getting kitted out with flying clothing and that sort of thing. But we certainly did no duties whatsoever. I did no clerical duties. I wasn't attached to any unit at all whilst at Uxbridge. It was just waiting to go on the first third of my flying training. The flying training was divided into three parts.
And now, what was the first part? Where were you sent?
Now, the first part was being trained at a civilian flying training school. And this was done actually in civilian clothes. I left Uxbridge in civvies and travelled down to Filton, which was the civilian flying training school where I was to receive my ab initio flying training on Tiger Moths. And for the whole of the time I was there, which was exactly 2 months, I was in civilian clothes the whole time. During that 2 months, one learned to fly, fly the aircraft, and the course consisted of 25 hours dual instruction and 25 hours solo flying, a 50-hour course, during which time one learned to handling of the Tiger Moth, takeoff, landing, the usual gliding turns, climbing, aerobatics such as loops, slow rolls, spins, and emergency action to be taken in the case of a forced landing, emergency action to be taken in the case of fire, simple navigation. It was just ab initio flying training. But at the end of it, one hadn't qualified to wear the pilot's brevet.
Did you have any problems with learning to fly?
No, but matter of fact, I took to it like a duck takes to water. Hadn't had any previous instruction at all, only flying as a passenger. I did quite well. On one occasion, I did a perfect landing, but unfortunately, I was about 4 feet away from the ground, and she dropped 4 feet like a stone, and the wheel came off. That caused a mouthful of bad language to be used by my flying instructor, who raced out on the fire tender. But except for that, and even in that case, the mechanics quickly put the wheel back on again, and my instructor shooed me off and sent me off solo again and said, "Now go and do a decent landing." Except for that one small thing, I never had any difficulty at all with my flying training, although several people were taken off the course, and all because of the same fault, not being able to judge their height when coming into land. And so the instructor could not have sufficient confidence to let them go solo.
Did you have the same instructor for the whole period?
No, I had two or three. It seemed to be the regular thing to change around and change to different pupils. Why? I never found out the reason.
These were civilian instructors.
These were civilian, but I think all of them had been RAF. They were all RAF reserve officers, had been in the RAF or on the reserve, yes.
Did you find that any of the ones that you had were better or worse than others?
Well, I can say this, that some I preferred more than others. Some, if you made a mistake, were more irate, more likely to swear, but I think they were all very good instructors, all of them. I learnt better when I'd got a bad-tempered instructor than when I had a kind instructor.
Did you have an actual RAF officer at Filton keeping an eye on you at all?
Not keeping his eye on us, but at the end of the course, giving us the chief flying instructor's test, and that was done with every pupil on completion of the course, and he took you up and then he assessed you according to the way you executed the various things he asked you to do, just as a driving instructor today or rather a driving examiner test somebody taking a test.
After you'd done this initial training at Filton, you were then posted to the 5th Flying Training School at Sealand.
Yes.
Now what were the next two phases of the instruction that took place at Sealand?
We were back to Uxbridge first and back into uniform again. I believe some more leave. And then...